This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. I hope you are safe and well wherever you are, and thank you so much for joining us today. I'm one of your co-hosts for this podcast, Shobana Xavier. Today we are joined by Dr. Jyoti Gulati Balachandran, who is an assistant professor of history at Pennsylvania State University, to discuss her new book, Narrative Past, The Making of a Muslim Community in Gujarat, circa 1400 to 1650, and it's been published by Oxford University Press in 2020. The book explores the complex power of Sufi text in creating Muslim communities in Gujarat from the 15th to the 17th centuries. Through a deep analysis of genealogical and biographical texts by Sufis, such as those of the Suhrawardi order, the study situates a social history of Gujarat. Balachandran focuses on three main Sufi saints, one being Amit Khatu, whose disciples chronicled his life and legacy through various literary productions in Arabic and Persian. The complex processes of textual production and architectural developments, such as Sufi shrines to these Sufi teachers in Gujarat, showcases a vibrant and complex history of Islam, one that hinges on Gujarat sultans, Sufi sheikhs, local Muslim communities, and much more. The book provides significant insights into Gujarat Sultanate and Sufism and their relationship, while also further complicating the history of medieval and early modern South Asian history. This book will be of interest to those who think and write about Sufism, especially in South Asia, South Asian Islamic history, sacred spaces, and textual production, and much more. In our conversation today, Dr. Balachandran and I spoke about some of the challenges of completing a research, especially looking for archival material, the context of multiglossic Gujarat, some of the diverse Sufi sources she engaged with, and how to approach Sufi literature as not merely hagiographical sources, but as texts that provide us other insights. The life and legacy of Amit Khatu, Sufi shrine dedicated to him and other figures, sacred spaces and its relationship to sultans, and much more. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Jyoti Gulati Balachandran about her new book, Narrative Past, The Making of a Muslim Community in Gujarat, from 1400 to 1650. Hi, Jyoti. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you doing?
Thanks, Shobana. Thanks for having me. I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm doing well. You know, it's the late summer and the pandemic is ongoing. So I'm grateful that you have given up some of your time to chat with us about a book that came out with Oxford University Press, Narrative Past, The Making of a Muslim Community in Gujarat, circa 1400 to 1650. We like to start our podcast to
get to know the author a little bit. So I wonder if you could give us a sense of, you know, your own intellectual journey and perhaps what led to this particular project.
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Shobhna. And, you know, once again, you know, thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure. You know, so a lot of my formative training, especially in terms of how to read Sufi texts and pose new questions to such material, it took place in Delhi University, where I was a graduate student, and I was fortunate to have the late Sunil Kumar, a historian of the Delhi Sultanate, as my teacher and mentor. Sunil's, you know, highly nuanced work on the complexities undergirding the expansion of a Muslim community in North India in the 13th and 14th century was actually very influential for me in multiple ways. For example, in thinking about the possibilities of recovering historical change in Sufi texts that can sometimes read very synchronic and formulaic, or reading Sufi texts not simply as sites of religious and theological concerns, but also as narratives that shaped how elite sections of the Muslim population related to and wrote about their past. And also that these narratives are, you know, very much in conversation with other Persian texts that are being produced at the court of the Delhi Sultans. And, you know, this was, you know, when I was a graduate student at Delhi University, it was also the time where, you know, the work of scholars like Simon Digby, Carl Ernst, you know, Richard Eaton, Niall Green, and others had really shifted the way historians were thinking about Sufi texts, and their collective work really brought Sufi literature into mainstream historiography on the medieval and early modern South Asia. So, you know, while I was doing my coursework as a graduate student in Delhi University, I actually went on to do an MPhil, where I had a first-hand experience of working very closely with a Sufi text under Sunil's supervision. This was a 14th century Tazkira, or biographical compendium, of Chishti Sufis and their disciples, called the Siyar al-Awliya. And one of the key aspects of my research then had been to expand our understanding of the social ties that bound learned Muslim men in the 14th century. So, you know, I showed in my MPhil dissertation that if we followed the structure of this text, such social ties are completely obscured. As the author privileged the multi-generational ties between Chishti peers and their proliferating circle of spiritual successors. But once you start connecting these men to all kinds of other details present in their biographies, you see how they're also related. You know, they are related to family ties, matrimonial ties. Many studied together under the same teachers. Some were also friends, and so on and so forth, right? So this aspect of recovering social history in Sufi texts, among, you know, many other lessons that I learned through my research, stayed with me as I pursued my PhD at UCLA under, you know, the guidance of Sanjay Subramaniam and Niall Green. My focus in Gujarat, though, was not really planned in any way. It really emerged in part through the coursework I did at UCLA, where, you know, we often talked about Gujarat's maritime context, but very little in terms of what was happening in the region away from its coastline. So, you know, at some point, the question of what's the state of Sufi lineages and history in Gujarat became very central to my historical inquiry. So I knew a lot about Sufis in North India and the Deccan, but hardly anything in the context of Gujarat. I mean, I couldn't think of a single, prominent Sufi from medieval Gujarat. So that question then, you know, guided me through my research, you know, as I collected several articles and, you know, publications in Urdu, especially on Sufis like Ahmad Khatu and his Sohrawardi contemporaries that I talk about in my book, you know, from the 15th century, and eventually ended up locating a diverse set of Persian materials that were produced between the 15th and the 17th, centuries. So, in many ways, you know, and this was the defining moment for my dissertation. And then I went on to further develop my ideas in the book Narrative Past to try and write a broader history of state and community formation in 15th century Gujarat. Mm.
It's so fascinating because I think this is probably one of the first books that I've read that had such a focus on Gujarat, which as I was reading, I was like, oh, I haven't had this history of Sufi kind of texts and spaces in kind of readings of South Asian Sufism generally. So I've definitely appreciated this aspect of it. another aspect that I appreciated, which you kind of shared with us in terms of your own intellectual journey, is just your engagement with text are so rich and so textured that I just really loved it. Were there, you know, challenges for you methodologically? I know in your introduction, you kind of talked about how you were traveling and, you know, came upon some of these private archives that people were willing and able to share with you, and that really kind of set the project forward. But I imagine it was kind of a daunting process to go and look for these texts, especially when you perhaps weren't quite sure how to look for them. So can you share with us some of that process and what the challenges and perhaps pleasant surprises were along the way?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this is the fun part of research, right? The unpredictability of what you're going to discover and also the kind of people you end up meeting while you're doing field work. But as I just mentioned, right, a lot of it, I have to say that a lot of credit for doing, you know, some of the groundwork with respect to these 15th century Sufis and the kind of texts that they produced, you know, was done by an earlier generation of scholars like, you know, B.A. Tirmizi or Ziauddin Desai, though much of their publication was not really available outside of the Indian subcontinent. But I was led to some, you know, archives in Gujarat really through their writings. And once I knew, the kind of, you know, places that actually are going to contain the original, you know, Persian manuscripts, that it really became a matter of, you know, going there and talking to people working in the archives and trying to, you know, get copies of those manuscripts. So luckily in Ahmedabad, there is a Pir Muhammad Shah library. It's a shrine library attached to the shrine of a Sufi. And they actually have a wide collection of manuscripts in Persian, Arabic, and also in Urdu and Gujarati. And that really became the primary site for me where I found a lot of these texts that I talk about in my book. And, you know, there is also this collaboration between the Shrine Library and the Iran Culture House in Delhi, where they're kind of digitizing many of these manuscripts. So that was really helpful. It's the kind of information that you don't really find until you actually go there, right? Like, I'm sure it happens with many of us. So until I went to the Pir Muhammad Shah Library, I had no idea that I could actually also go to the Iran Culture House and get digital copies of these texts. The other kind of more challenging aspect of doing research was that, and as you pointed out, I mentioned this in my book, that there are still manuscripts that continue to be housed in private collections, and there are also other shrine libraries that have manuscripts, but they're not easily accessible to scholars for research. So at some point, I had to make a decision of how far I wanted to go, and I feel I've barely scratched the surface. There are a lot more stuff that is out there waiting to be explored. But on the flip side, because of spending time in Gujarat, I was able to meet people who were really excited by the fact that I was interested in learning about these 15th, 16th century Sufis, and, you know, several of them actually were descendants of the Sufis that I talk about in the book. So they were very excited about my project. And then one of them actually, you know, opened his library to me, his private collection. And that was really a high point for me to actually go to Mangrol, which is kind of so far away from Ahmedabad. I remember going with my husband, and, you know, I had an infant at that time. And this person just kind of opened his house to my family, and he took out all of these manuscripts that he had. He showed me this long genealogical chart of Shajara, and as well as other manuscripts that were, you know, sadly crumbling away. And he was very much involved in transcribing whatever he could from these manuscripts, and also get them published and get them out there. So that, as I said, that was like a really, it was, you know, I don't think I still, I can claim that I have the full knowledge of the full breadth of manuscripts that were produced in the period, during the period that I'm working on. But through the generosity of several people in Gujarat, I was able to gather enough material that I could actually start thinking about some of the questions that I raise in my book.
That's so fascinating. And yeah, the kind of the epithet, the introduction of the book starts with you going to this individual's house and him sharing the genealogical chart and placing himself in was like just such a fascinating something as a reader I just was like so enthralled by. And I think this really kind of gets at what you're doing in the book, which is the living reality of the text that you're engaging with, which I think is so fascinating. So I really appreciated that story. I wonder if there's quite a few aspects or moving pieces of the book. And so I wonder if we could kind of tackle a few of them and then set up kind of the broader arguments that you're engaging with. And I guess the first thing is kind of the landscape of 15th, 16th, and towards the end of the book, 17th century Gujarat that you're dealing with. So what should we readers or listeners know about the geography or the context into which you're engaging these texts and these Sufis, and that is of Gujarat, and perhaps also something about the multiglossic, and you're kind of alluding to it already, kind of the different linguistic traditions that are informing Muslim communities and kind of state relationships in these settlements that you're talking about?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So, for those listeners who are not familiar with the region of Gujarat, this is a region in the northwest part of the Indian subcontinent, along the coastline of the Arabian Sea. And as I have, as I discussed this quite a bit in the introduction to my book, Gujarat is now a modern state in modern India, right? So those are not the boundaries that I am looking at. That state in modern India came into existence only in 1960. So one of the things I want the listeners and the readers of my book to be aware is that, as I look at the region of Gujarat, the region is actually, kind of historically defined. Right? It's contingent. Its definitions, its understandings are contingent on the time period that we're looking at, and also, whose perspective that we are privileging. So in my book, clearly, I'm privileging the perspective of Sufi masters and their disciples who were writing in Gujarat between the 15th and the 17th century. But having said that, there is this general idea by the 15th century that when one finds mentions to the region of Gujarat, that there is a political sense in which Gujarat is understood. Right? So this is kind of the political domain of the Gujarat Sultans who come to power in the 15th century in this region, and before them you had the Chalukyas who ruled in the same geography. So there is this. So Gujarat is understood in those kind of in that political sense. But again, if you were to look at these Sufi texts that I've worked on, Gujarat also appears as a spiritual dominion. It's a dominion that is led by the Sufis and their descendants. And as as you kind of mentioned, the sort of multiglossic environment in Gujarat, this is the time where you also see, very much like other parts of the Indian subcontinent, an increasing literary vernacularization, right, where vernaculars are increasingly used as modes of literary expression. So in Gujarat, we, for example, see the literalization of Gujarati and Gujari, which is, Gujarati inflected Urdu. Of course, you also have languages like the Apabhramsha and Sanskrit that have a much longer history of literary production in Gujarat. And then you have, Persian and Arabic, the languages that I focus on in my book. And even, when you're looking at these Persian and Arabic texts being produced in, 15th century, 16th century Gujarat, you also see an increasing application of vernacular vocabulary in these texts, as well as Sufi compositions in Gujari later on. So, so pretty much like, the religious landscape of Gujarat, where you have, Jain pilgrimage centers and Jain temples, and, you have the presence of, the Ismaili community, you have Sufis of different spiritual dispensation, very, very much like this kind of religious sectarian landscape, you have a diversity of languages and texts in Gujarat as well. So this is kind of the larger, if I were to situate Gujarat, these are some of the things that I would I would highlight. And as we move into the late 16th and 17th century, one of the big changes that you see is, of course, in relation to the political dispensation in the region. So the Gujarat Sultans come to power at the turn of the 15th century, but pretty much by the middle of the 16th century, their power is on the decline, and in the last quarter of the 16th century, the Mughals take over, and Gujarat becomes a province of the Mughal Empire. So some of the Sufi texts that I'm looking at that are produced in the late 16th or the 17th century are already produced under this new political dispensation of the Mughal emperors in the region. Mm-hmm.
And so perhaps we could talk about some of the Sufi literature and what kind of Sufi literature you are looking at. And you've already mentioned kind of biographies as an example. And what kind of questions are you asking when you're looking at those texts, you know, to consider a broader social history of this region that you've just described for us?
Yeah, so there's a broad array of Sufi literature. Right. And again, one of the things that I point out to readers in my book is that I avoid using the term hagiography, because when you look at these Sufi texts as hagiographical literature, it obscures the considerable diversity and authorial choices that lay behind the composition of each of these texts. So in my book, I think most of my texts would be categorized as either malfuzat, which are the collections of the public assemblies of Sufi sheikhs, and the tazkirat, or these are the biographical compendia that can be arranged in a variety of ways. So some of the questions that I going with this awareness that these texts that I'm looking at, that each has, in each of these texts, the authors have made some very conscious decisions about what genre to write in. Because by the time you come to 15th century Gujarat, there's a long history of production, of literary production by Sufi masters and their disciples in other places in South Asia. Right? So North India, the text that I alluded to earlier, the Sirat al-Awliya, which is written as a tazkira of the Chishti Sufis and their disciples. You also have the Malfuzat text. So, you see that their production in North India, you see them, in the Deccan. So so as I was looking at these texts, I was like, why are they kind of putting my texts in conversations, if you like, with this larger history of Sufi texts in the Indian subcontinent, because my authors were clearly aware of earlier texts that had been written in their genres, right? So why are they choosing to write their remembrances or their collections of the teachings of their Sufi masters and their lives in a particular genre? So that was like one of the questions. And then I think the other, as I moved, from the 15th to the 17th century, it also became clear to me that I need to put these texts in conversation with each other in Gujarat itself, because most of the texts that I look at focus on the lives and teachings of three prominent 15th century Sufis. And so Ahmad Khatu is one, and then the two Sohrawardis that I talk about, Burhanuddin Abdullah and Sirajuddin Muhammad Shahi Alam, right? So, what changes then in these texts as we move from these earlier inscriptions of their lives in the 15th century, moving into the 17th century? And that was actually, that in some ways really kind of defined my book, because I was able to show historical change, to show how the decisions about what genre to write in enabled, for example, authors writing in the 17th century to synthesize material and theorize on who was important among their ancestors from the 15th century. So the genre of a biographical compendium was much more kind of desirable in that way than just a collection of the public assemblies of their ancestors. So I think so those were some of the ways in which I approached these Sufi texts and accounted for the considerable diversity that existed in terms of their genre, in terms of their narrative strategies, and really kind of thinking, making it very central to how I read these Sufi texts.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And you've just modeled such an amazing way for us to really be sensitive to Sufi genre, but also like how to extract from them to understand broader context. So I think, as you say, we often have a tendency to just like blanketly approach them as hagiographical texts, but then we lose so much. And so it was really fascinating to see how you modeled it for us, and so appreciative of that about this book. As you mentioned, there are kind of three Sufi personalities that you engage with. And I think Ahmed Khatu kind of stands out as one of the prominent ones in the book. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we could get into him first and kind of talk about what it is that we learn, I mean, perhaps who he is first, and then maybe we could shift to talking about some of the ways that his disciples kind of wrote about him and what that means, both as a literary exercise, but also what they were trying to do in terms of positioning his authority and spiritual domain after his passing.
Yeah, thank you. I love the opportunity to talk about Ahmed Khatu because that was really such a fascinating figure for me. And it was in part fascinating because actually when I went to Gujarat and I learned about his tomb shrine, I was just blown away. I was like, why don't we know about this Sufi more? Because yeah, his like tomb shrine complex, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about that later, but it was just fabulous. I mean, it was just kind of so huge, right? It was a really, really large complex. And so it clearly, told the visitor that this was somebody very, very prominent, that somebody spent a lot of money in building this up. So who's Ahmed Khatu? Unfortunately, Ahmed Khatu is not one of the kind of the more, he didn't belong to a very prestigious Sufi lineage. He's not like one of the Chishtis or the Sohrawardis who were extremely popular in South Asia in the medieval period. I should also preface that, of course, much of our understanding of who he is and, what he did in his life really comes from these texts that his disciples wrote around the middle of the 15th centuries. And these disciples, of course, spent a lot of time in Gujarat. But, we know from these texts that he is somebody who was actually born in Delhi to a family of military commanders. And apparently there was a dust storm once in Delhi, and that, he was a very young kid. He got lost in that storm, was picked by a caravan of traders who were moving between Delhi and Rajasthan. And they took this young boy with them and brought him to a local Sufi, Baba's Hawk, in a village called Khatu, which is in northern Rajasthan. Of course, the disciples of Ahmed Khatu would later embellish this account, as one would expect, to say that Baba Ishaq already had some kind of premonition that he was going to find a young boy who was going to become a great Sufi peer. But we know that then Ahmed Khatu grew under the tutelage of Baba Ishaq, who belonged to the Maghribi silsila. And Maghrib, as the name suggests, is a Sufi order that emerges in the Maghrib, northwest Africa. But again, as I mentioned earlier, unlike the Chishtis and the Sohrawardis and other, the Naqshbandis and the Qadris, who we know a lot about, we actually do not have much information on the Maghribi silsila in the Indian subcontinent. At some point towards the late 1379, actually, that Baba Ishaq passes, and Ahmed Khatu is really moved by his death, and he decides to leave Khatu and start his travels. And once again, we don't know how much of the travel that is related by his disciples was actually taken by the Sufi, but some of the important stops were again Delhi, a city that he was very familiar with, because even when he was with Baba Ishaq, he would often frequent Delhi and hang out with other Sufis and scholars in Delhi. And we find him in Delhi actually at the time that Timur's army is sacking Delhi towards the end of the 14th century, 1398, 1399. And there are these all these episodes that the disciples relate about how he was actually very helpful to the prisoners, to the people who had been taken prisoners by the Timurid army. And you know, at some point, the word reached to Timur, who then asked Amakadu to accompany him to Samarkand. So then there's a whole set of travels that we are told about in Central Asia. He's in Samarkand. He makes all his way down to Mecca, and then finally at the turn of the 15th century, we find him back in Gujarat. He comes back, and he is actually on his way to the Deccan. So he's again, somebody who is, looking for patronage, looking to find a place to finding a residence for himself. And it is at this point that we actually, there is a kind of, he ends up meeting with the Zafar Khan, who would actually end up becoming the first Sultan of the Gujarat Sultanate. And it is here that Zafar Khan makes this request to Sheikh Hemmat. And he's like, hey, why are you going to the Deccan? Why don't you settle here in Gujarat, find a nice spot and make your residence here? So already then we can see from this very point onward, this kind of intersection between this kind of political authority and somebody like Ahmed Khatu, who can really serve to legitimize the power of Zafar Khan as he's trying to establish his independent authority in Gujarat. Going back to the text and how they relate the life of Ahmed Khatu, and then what happens once he settles down in this beautiful spot in Sarkhej by a pond, we can clearly see that we cannot really talk about the formation of the state under the Gujarat Sultans and the establishment of Sufi Khanqah, the Sufi residences in Gujarat, as two separate processes, that these are really conjoined processes, that what we see in the 15th century Gujarat from the very beginning is an understanding by these disciples that these are the formation of the state and the community and the Muslim community spearheaded by the Sufis. These are actually conjoined processes. And so you find a variety of other examples where Sheikh Ahmed Khatu and the subsequent sultans in Gujarat maintained their relationship. There was, of course, conflict at times, but clearly, we see them as collaborators, especially in the way the narratives are defined. These are not kind of mutually exclusive kind of entities that are guiding the Muslim community, that they are working together in ensuring the expansion and the prosperity of the Muslim community in Gujarat.
Mm-hmm. It's so fascinating. And I think chapter 3 on sacred spaces, which I think we're both excited to talk about, is the one that really gets at this, especially the relationship between the sultans and Ahmed Khatu, and kind of the placement of Sufi tombs and kind of the sultans being entombed there. So can we talk a little bit about this really, really fascinating and expansive space and kind of the relationship between the textual production? And there's an amazing line you have in the book, and I wrote it down. It says the twin processes of textual production and physical enshrinement reinforced each other. And I think if we hear a little bit about the shrine space, we'll kind of get a sense of what you're describing in the text is also happening in kind of physical enshrinement.
That's right. And and these processes, I have to say that they take place differently in with regard to Ahmed Khatu and his Sohrawardi contemporaries. In the case of Ahmed Khatu, there is by the time it appears, because it's very hard to date the two texts that his disciples wrote, except for the fact that they're probably written soon after Ahmed Khatu's passing. But that textual commemoration in the case of Ahmed Khatu is accompanied by the interests by the Gujarat Sultans in actually enshrining his tomb as well. The shrine complex is important because it is the context in which the texts of Ahmed Khatu's disciples are are likely narrated. Like they provide the physical space for the community to come together, not only seek blessings from the buried Sufis, but also, you know, hear about his life and about his wisdom and about his, you know, about his travels and about his teachings. So in that sense, you know, it's kind of, you know, texts really, you know, texts become important to the popularity of the shrine. And of course, the shrine reinforces the need to have those texts. If you have this, you know, beautiful shrine complex, people would want to know, who is this Sufi? What do we know about this? And so this kind of reinforcement is very much at the heart of Ahmad Khatu's memorialization soon after he passes. Of course, as you know from that chapter, one of the other reasons why Ahmad Khatu's tomb shrine is so important is because when you have there is this Gujarat Sultan Mahmud Begra, who then ruled from 1458 to 1511, he is actually very instrumental in further expanding the tomb shrine of Ahmad Khatu. And he expands this not only by adding several palatial structures to this complex. So we have, you know, if you go, you know, you'll read about, oh, this used to be, you know, King's Palace or Queen's Palace, and you still have actually a lot of those structures that have survived. You see all these like pillars and you know, this huge lake around the site that has recently been revived. So there's finally water again in this lake. But you have palatial structures, but also the presence of royal funerary structures. And it really struck me because, you know, I was reminded of Fatehpur Sikri, this kind of short-lived capital under the Mughal Emperor Akbar, where you have the tomb of Selim Chishti within the palatial compound in Fatehpur Sikri. But here I was looking at this tomb shrine, which is actually completely the other way around. It's the tomb shrine first, and then you have these palatial structures that are built around the tomb shrine. And it was supposed to be kind of a summer retreat for the sultans of Gujarat. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the presence of royal funerary structures. So you have Mahmud Begra himself, and two other Gujarat sultans and their wives that are buried in one section of this tomb complex. So that, you know, as you rightly pointed out, Shobhna, it was very clear for me, both by reading the texts as well as actually looking at how this tomb complex was constructed, that again, what we're looking at is this kind of looking at this, you know, the formation of the Sultanate and the Muslim community in the 15th century as really these kind of conjoined processes and I think I relate this in my book, that oftentimes when I, you know, visited Ahmad Khatu's shrine, I would see other visitors who would, you know, seek blessings from Ahmad Khatu, and then they move on to the part where the Gujarat sultans are buried, and they would go and pay their respects. And it's kind of very—it's not very common to see somebody praying at the tombs of the, you know, of the sultans. But mm-hmm. But again, it's this idea that if you're thinking about Ahmad Khatu, the sultans were very they carefully inscribed themselves in the way Ahmad Khatu would be remembered, whether especially you know, whether you look at these texts or whether you look at this huge shrine complex.
Mm. And you also mentioned in the book, as you're discussing this relationship between the sultans and Ahmad Khatu specifically, is how it so much contrasts what we perceive with the Shishti Sufis and their shrines of like a separation between, the political leaders and the Sufis, right? And in that they, you know, there's a popular story of coming in through one, I think Nizamuddin Aulia, the emperor comes through one door, the Sufi leaves through the back, right? And here, right? This is a contrast immediately of Ahmad Khatu. And you can see it in the pictures you have in the book, is that the, you know, the sultans are buried right next to him. And
so absolutely. Really
fascinating.
Right.
And so I feel like we could keep talking about spaces, you and I, but we should probably get to some other aspects of the book. Chapters 4 and 5 shift, and they focus on some literary productions by Sirwardi disciples, and they're also shifting a little bit in time period too. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about chapter 4's goals, or kind of what you're doing, which is really, I found really fascinating, is what the establishment of lineage or genealogy means for you know, the particular community that you're engaging with, especially for the sorority community, and what they're doing with text in terms of constructing lineage. Some of it felt like that it was, I don't know if transnational is the right word, but they were trying to locate themselves in the Gujarati context, and what it meant, the significance of that for community formation. But the building of networks and using kind of this process of building, you know, family tree or genealogy was very important. So can you say a little bit about what is happening here and why this kind of literary production was important for the sorority individuals that you're engaging?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Shobhna. And, you know, again, it sort of reminds me of how much I enjoy connecting people, right? Just finding these links and, you know, lineages and thinking about how they're connected with each other in multiple ways. Right. So thinking about the Swaravardhis, right, it actually, you know, goes back to what I, you know, what I said a few minutes ago about, you know, putting texts produced in the 15th century in conversation with those produced in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. Because all these texts in one way or the other use Ahmad Khatu and his two 15th century Swaravardhi, you know, contemporaries as their focus. But, it, you know, what is what? And so one of the things that you see and something that I kind of detail in the fourth chapter is that these texts that are written at this later point, kind of lineage really becomes a central kind of organizing theme for these texts. And it's for a variety of reasons. You know, first of all, you actually have the kind of historical depth now in Gujarat that the ancestors of these descendants who are writing these texts, you know, did not. They had just arrived in Gujarat, and the literary production was not of the kind that could talk about their long-term association with Gujarat. Right? So what you see in the 17th century texts is that becomes possible now. It becomes possible to trace a lineage, also assert its regional aspect, that this is, you know, the ancestors come to Gujarat, that these are Sufis of Gujarat, and to also then show how these Sufis, who really in these texts appear as leaders of an expanding Muslim community, you can actually now in these texts trace that expansion, because you know multiple family members, multiple generations of descendants who have gone on to, you know, marry into other families, other learned families. Many of them have often left Ahmedabad and moved to other cities in Gujarat. So one of the things I'm trying to accomplish at the fourth chapter is by kind of, you know, looking at these lineages and be able to actually show how this kind of community of, you know, elite Sufis and their descendants expands over the course of, you know, the 15th and the 16th century, which is hard to do in the 15th century. But these texts are also important, in relation to what we find on Ahmad Khatu, right? Because, as I said, these the two Swaravardhis, Burhanuddin Abdullah and Sirajuddin Muhammad, who actually at some point are also students of Ahmad Khatu, unlike Ahmad Khatu, they had families, right? So we have the descendants who also served as the spiritual successors of their ancestors. And Ahmad Khatu never married, never had had a son who could be his spiritual, you know, successor. So his kind of lineage, when you had the tomb shrine and the text, but there was not an ongoing, there was not a continuing spiritual lineage that we can trace. So in the case of the Swaravardhi, there is a much greater investment on the part of Swaravardhi descendants in the upkeep of the tomb shrines of their 15th century ancestors, and also then in the production of texts that would talk about the significance of their 15th century ancestors. And so what you see in the 17th century is something I call like the second narrative moment. The first is in the middle of the 15th century, where you see mostly texts dedicated to Ahmad Khatu, not so much on the Sohrawardis. We have, you know, we have some references, but, you know, we don't really know the extent of that production, literary production. But suddenly in the late 16th and the early 17th century, there are a variety of texts that some of the descendants of the Sohrawardis start writing. And as they write, it's, you know, they have to account for the presence of a very, very important contemporary of their 15th century ancestors. How do you account for the prominence that Sheikh Ahmad Kantu continued to enjoy in many of the narratives, especially like Mughal biographical compendia that are written in the 16th century, 17th century, where you find very little detail on the Sohrawardis, 15th century Sohrawardis, but you find a lot of detail on Ahmad Kantu. And so clearly these later Mughal biographers are relying on Ahmad Kantu's 15th century texts. So it's almost like there is this kind of lacuna, right? There's not much out on the Sohrawardis, 15th century Sohrawardis. And so you have a couple of very prominent scholars and Sufis who are descendants of Sirajuddin Muhammad and Burhanuddin Abdullah, who write a variety of texts and try to account for Ahmad Khatu's popularity vis-a-vis their own ancestors. And so this is a theme that I pick up that, you know, as we think about Sufi lineage in Gujarat, you can see a sense of competition also, right? That there is this need to for good reason, to kind of really present one's own ancestor in a much more kind of superior spiritual light. The Sohrawardi descendants are also, as I pointed out earlier, are working in a context where the Mughal emperors are around, and Mughal emperors are capable of, and they do continue to offer patronage and land grants and other kinds of forms of respect to these Sohrawardi descendants. So as I'm sort of thinking about how these texts are relating Ahmad Khatu's memory in their own remembrances of their ancestors, I kind of look very closely on these two Sohrawardi texts in my fifth chapter to kind of understand what kind of changes or what kind of omissions or additions the Sohrawardi descendants made to their memory of their ancestors to account for Ahmad Khatu's popularity. And in these accounts, Ahmad Khatu's authority is certainly not diminished by any account. You know, he's still recognized as a very prominent Sufi and a learned person, but it's really, it's subsumed within the more prominent, the more illustrious lineage of the Sohrawardis. So the fifth chapter is really about kind of showing again how we really need to put these texts in conversation with one another. So the text that one Sohrawardi wrote, where he narrated 40 episodes from Sirajuddin Muhammad's life, we need to put that in context with Sadhikayat, where I have like 100 episodes written by another descendant. And so, and that these are not just kind of additions of more episodes, that they are trying to achieve something. They're trying to put to rest any kind of thoughts that people might have about, who actually is more important and who actually was more central to the flourishing of the Muslim community in Gujarat, Ahmad Kantu or the Sohrawardis.
Mm. And yeah, your discussion of Saad Hikayat in chapter 5 is just so fascinating for this reason, because you could see how the author of the text is recasting authority and kind of looking at preserving the spiritual legacy of Ahmad Khatu, especially because he doesn't have descendants. And in this way, I think one of the themes that you kind of talk about throughout the book is this idea of memory. And it seems that all of these kind of the text, the space, and kind of the establishment of lineage is really trying to preserve memory. And it's interesting, as you were just speaking, it sparked this idea that, family descendants are part of that memory. And so what happens when Ahmad Khatu doesn't have that element of memorialization for him? How does the text do other work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of, that actually, the interesting thing here, though, is that, despite not having any clear spiritual successors or descendants, right? I mean, it is really Ahmad Khatu that receives a much more space in later biographical compendia that are like really kind of subcontinental in their framework. So they're looking at different regions of the Indian subcontinent, you know, like, you know, Abdul Haq Safwanullahyar. You look at that, right? He's talking about all the, different parts of the Indian subcontinent. And you have this kind of really long narration of Ahmad Fatu's life. And there's hardly anything on his contemporaries or Sohrawardis. So it's kind of a little bit of like irony there.
Right, exactly. That's really fascinating. I mean, what is his legacy today? You kind of talk about this in the conclusion, what's happening with the Ahmad Fatu's shrine space, and it's become very touristic and popularized. But I mean, what is the legacy of him, or perhaps even the other Sohrawardi teachers that you're engaging with?
Well, it's like, you know, I would say it's like a legacy that's, you know, it's kind of, it can be considered a conflicted legacy, right? Depending on who you talk to. But in terms of, I mean, for a long, if you look at colonial records, right, where they talk about the state of different monuments, you know, in Gujarat, you would find references to, you know, how much money they were spending for the upkeep of this shrine, of Ahmad Khatu's shrine complex, or just kind of, you know, giving descriptions of how it was in a it was kind of deteriorating. So, and you know, so for a long period of time, in the 18th, 19th, large part of the 20th century, this was kind of, it was really a neglected site. And also it also has to do with how the geography in the region sort of developed, where this village of Khatu became more and more disconnected from the old historic, you know, Ahmedabad. It was like harder to get to and all of that. But then there was like a highway put there. And so it became way more accessible. And then there's like a local NGO that with the help of the ASI then sort of really focused on reviving, because, you know, as I said, it's an enormous site. It's kind of hard to miss. So there was considerable interest from this NGO to not only kind of revive the structures, just clear up the shrine complex, you know, get water back into the lake, but also involve the local community in kind of preserving this structure. But because it's not, again, it's very different from the tomb shrines of the Sohrawardis, right? Because they are very much, they have remained in part because there has always been a clear line of spiritual succession, which is also a line of family descendants. Then those sites have remained very important sites of pilgrimage for people to visit. And I don't think that really changed much. And, you know, you have even, you know, I think I talk about the Jahangir Nama, where the emperor Jahangir talks about his visit to Ahmedabad. And, you know, while he goes and sees Ahmad Khatu's shrine, he actually is able to meet the descendants of the Sohrawardi Sufis that are buried in the other tomb shrines, right? So that, again, that element of having descendants, a clear line of descendants, really shaped the way in which these tomb shrines like developed. And so now, with all of the efforts of this NGO, it's become, you look at brochures, in Ahmedabad and say, hey, don't miss going to, you know, some cage, you find some kind of peace and quiet, from all of the kind of the hustle and bustle of like Ahmedabad. Now there's like there's a Rosa committee, they have built a small kind of library. But people really kind of, you know, and they, you know, and, you know, over the years, you've had all kinds of concerts. People claim that there was one time where the Hindu festival of Janmashtami, you know, was celebrated in this tomb complex, kind of reviving this memory of this, again, Sufi as somebody who catered to all sections of the population. So it's become a kind of a tourist site, which is very different from the experience of visiting the Sohrawardi tomb shrines, because they're just like, you know, many of the other shrines in South Asia, where there's a constant flow of people, coming and seeking, blessings. So they've kind of continued to be very much a part of the community so when I visit, you know, I visit Ahmad Khatu's tomb as a tourist, really. But right. When I'm visiting the other tomb, I'm like, I'm not a tourist. I'm like, just like, all these people coming there, it's kind of a pilgrimage site, more than anything else. So, again, as I said, it's, one way or the other, I think thinking about the legacy, right? I mean, again, the continued presence of these two shrines, despite their different trajectory, again, is a very good reminder of the importance of these Sufis, in Gujarat, in kind of defining the sort of the regional kind of landscape and the sacred landscape in Gujarat. I mean, you cannot just kind of wish them away. They're very much there, and they continue to be important.
It's so fascinating. As we wrap up and taking a kind of a step back from all the wonderful details we've been talking about, what would you want our listeners or readers who are going to pick up your book to really take away as the broader aims or interventions that your project is making?
There are at least a couple of things, right? I mean, again, thinking about how I got to really think about Gujarat as the focus of my research, right? So that a lot of what we hear about Gujarat is oriented towards its maritime context, its relationships to other places across the Western Indian Ocean. And that is certainly very, very important. In fact, those kinds of connections were important for bringing a variety of Sufis and other learned Muslim men to Gujarat in the first place. And we know that the Gujarat sultans clearly paid attention to the port cities that brought a lot of trade into the region, and they also harbored links with Mecca. So I guess one of the interventions that I I'm hoping to make through this book is that while that's important, let's also make sure that we understand that a lot of that's happening in Gujarat is also connected to the historical processes, the narrative processes that are shaping the past and the identity of Muslim communities in other parts of the Indian subcontinent. So if you want to understand the role and reception of Sufi texts that are produced in Gujarat, we really need to put them in conversation with this much longer history of the production of these materials in North India and the Deccan, and how it was in these texts that a certain kind of texted past was being created by a variety of authors. I guess the other important question that I hope I'm able to provide some answer to is about, what do we mean when we say, what is the history of the Muslim community in Gujarat? And more often than not, we start talking about the sultans, right? We talk about the pre-conquest of Gujarat sultans, and that, so this kind of equation that the history of the Muslim community equates the rise of quote-unquote Muslim power in Gujarat. I'm trying to kind of dislodge that a little bit, because I think that there were alternate contemporary ways of giving a composite identity to the history of the Muslim community in Gujarat, right? So for example, the ones that I recover in Sufi texts. And also that these alternate ways of giving historical depth to the Muslim community were not necessarily mutually exclusive to the manner in which the sultans were representing their role in the expansion and flourishing of a regional Muslim community. So, and as I've said before, right, I mean, really looking at the 15th century as very much the state and community formation are very much conjoined processes, and that reading texts produced both in the court of the Gujarat sultans and in the Sufi khanqahs kind of reinforces the importance of this conjoined process. And I guess, if I were to add maybe one more thing, and that is, of course, the idea of like a regional community and a regional history. Kind of just thinking about the role of narrative texts in placemaking and in region making. How these texts that I look at, especially the ones that are produced later in the late 16th and 17th centuries, are able to very clearly express this deep attachment to the idea and geography of Gujarat. So, there's this sort of this placemaking and region making in these texts is inseparable from the ways in which the authors are constructing their past and narrating their past in these texts. So, you know, and then, you know, that's, you know, one of the reasons why I have narrative pasts in the title of the book, because these kind of narratives are really kind of the aspect of the narrative expression in a variety of texts is really central to how we understand region making, you know, and also, you know, regional kind of identity making in the 15th century.
Fascinating. You've definitely given us a lot to think about and sit with. As we are concluding our conversation, I wonder, I know I want to recognize that we're in kind of an intense global moment, and you've also just published a book. And so hopefully you're sitting with that and honoring that and celebrating that. But I imagine that this book has probably left you with new questions or brought new projects to mind. And is there something that you're working on or you're thinking about, hoping that your next project could be?
Yeah, no, it's, you know, as it turns out, I'm actually, you know, kind of reorienting towards the Western Indian Ocean again, myself. Okay. So, you know, so much for talking about Gujarat being connected to, you know, these larger processes. I'm actually kind of looking towards the Western Indian Ocean again. You know, there are, I guess I'm trying to kind of, in my next project, try to kind of focus more on Arabic narrative text. You know, my book is largely based on Persian text, a little bit of Arabic text, but there are some significant texts that are produced in Arabic in Gujarat and in Mecca by people who moved from Gujarat and settled in Mecca. So I'm kind of very interested in 16th century, you know, figure of Qutbuddin Muhammad al-Nehrawali, who's kind of a very important kind of religious scholars who gains a lot of reputation in Mecca after moving from Nehrawala or Patan in North Gujarat. And, you know, he's written a variety of, you know, Arabic texts and all of, you know, and then, you know, you also have his contemporaries. We have somebody like, you know, Ulukhani, who has written, and I talk about that text in my book, it was written Arabic History of Gujarat. You have members of the prominent either Rusi Silsila who are in Gujarat, and you know they're also writing in Arabic. So kind of thinking about the scholarly connections in 16th century between Gujarat and the Red Sea region in a way that I can actually really kind of you know put these texts produced on different sides of the Western Indian Ocean world in connection, in kind of connect them and kind of bring them into conversation with one another. But, you know, the project is still at its very infancy, so I have no idea how it's going to shape up. But I'm pretty certain about, as I said, about my orientation towards the Western Indian Ocean for my next project.
Well, that's exciting. It's always exciting when the project is just starting and it's like fun to think about the possibilities. So I wish you all the best with that. And again, thank you so much, Odi, for joining us and to talking about your book. I appreciate your time and congratulations again on a fantastic book.
Thank you so much, Shobhna. And I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity to talk about my work. Thanks for reading it. And thanks for all your questions. And I really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Me too. Thank you.
And that was my conversation with Jyothi Gulati Balachandran about Narrative Past, the Making of a Muslim Community in Gujarat, circa 1400 to 1650, which is published by Oxford University Press. I hope you enjoyed our conversation and I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, stay well and take good care.